Hi, it's Holly Tanner.
And Justin Weaver.
We're from Something to Talk About, and you're listening to 90.7 FM.
WGXC, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson.
Hello, WGXC listeners. This is Kelly McCon. Campbell Hudson is hosting its monthly dinner on Tuesday, February 6th at 5:30 in our Solaris building, 360 Warren Street. Come experience community and meet new people and old friends over a freshly prepared meal made by our local volunteers. Everyone is invited and no one will be turned away. We will be glad to see you there, and please bring a friend.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Milad H. Mazari in Murray, Utah. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply.
I'm trying to get the people saying frequency.
Really? Frequency.
No,
not frequency. Frequency.
Got some frequencies.
Yeah.
You're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. This program is Frequency, and my name is Mayuko. I am live broadcasting from Acre Studio. A little bit rainy today. I hope you're having a beautiful Saturday morning, beautiful beginning of the weekend, but the weather is not like super fantastic. On the way coming here, driving, I was thinking, you know, I always enjoy coming to Accra to do my radio show here, surrounded by the mountains, like always get to see mountains right there from the window. And you know, mountains are always beautiful no matter what the weather is. Like on a sunny day, it's beautiful. On the cloudy day, it's beautiful. On the foggy day, it's beautiful. And really makes you want to, you know, be a better person on any kind of weather day. But then I arrived and saw outside window, and the because it's so cloudy and rainy, the mountain's not there. It's like completely obscured. So there are such days, but, you know, that's life. And I'm still hoping to get to see red-breasted nuthatch outside in this art park of Wave Farm. This is where we are at. I've seen it before. I've heard it before, so I'm hoping maybe I can find it after this show. But for now, I hope you're sticking around, sitting on a comfortable couch and staying warm and cozy, listening to the radio. Again, this program is Bequency, and this show invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our own neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sound made by birds and humans inspired by birds. We started today's show with a little field recording of Wood Thrush by Bernard Fort, a French composer and ornithologist, and the track was from his 1996 release titled Composition Ornithologique, in English, Ornithological Compositions. And we're going to hear more from this recording later, but now, for now, we're going to listen to an interview with Bill Cook, a Cleverec native, professor emeritus of ornithology, and curator of the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum. Bill is not only an expert birder himself, but also a huge supporter of the local birders community. He has helped others to become a better birders and find careers in the environmental field for nearly 50 years. And we're going to listen to his stories of birding trips, his work as an ornithologist, and his encounter with the feather thief as a teacher. There's a little bit of a crime, like a mystery component to today's show, so I hope you enjoy. And Chris Franks from the Alan DeVoe Bird Club also joins the conversation today, because there will be an event at the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum that is organized by the club. This is a rare opportunity to view its ornithological collection, and it's happening on Saturday, February 10th, and you'll hear what kind of, you know, interesting things you get to see at this event. So without further ado, let's listen to my interview with Bill Cook and Chris Franks. Thanks for tuning in. This is Bequency on WGXC. Could you briefly introduce yourself?
Okay, yes. Hello. My name is Bill Cook. I'm currently the curator of the Natural History Museum at Columbia Green Community College. I'm a native of Columbia County. I was born in Claverick. I have a PhD in ornithology, and I taught general biology and other courses at Columbia Green for many years, nearly 50 years.
I'm Chris Franks. I'm Bill's understudy. I live part-time in Columbia County in East Chatham since 2008, and I am a very active and enthusiastic birder.
And I have asked both of you to come to speak for this radio show Bequency today, because there will be an upcoming event at the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum, and so we're going to talk about that a little later. But first, I want to ask more about you personally. And so you said you were born in Columbia County and you were raised here.
That's correct.
And so could you talk a little bit about like how your interest in birds started?
Oh, yes, that's easy. When I first started teaching at Columbia Green, they offered some Saturday credit-free courses. And as an employee there, I got to take them for free. So I immediately signed up for several courses. I signed up for one in mixology, how to make drinks. And I signed up for one with Rich Guthrie on bird watching. So it was Rich Guthrie who got me started. And he's been my mentor throughout my career pretty much. And so I have to thank him for getting me started.
Mm-hmm. Rich Guthrie, a lot of
correct.
People must be familiar from his appearance on WAMC.
That's correct.
The birding show.
That's correct.
Right. So that's Rich. And that's when?
Well, 1976, I guess, is when it first started for me.
So it's not like you grew up watching birds, right?
Oh, well, my early childhood experiences, my father was influential there. He taught me hunting, fishing, and trapping. I knew game birds, of course, because we shot them and ate them.
You ate them?
Yes.
So you know how to, how do you call it, like dress them?
Sure, skin them and cook them. Yes.
Huh.
Yes, that's growing up in Columbia County in the 1950s.
Would that skill probably help with your preparing birds?
I suppose so, sure. Growing up, I skinned muskrats and other things in my trapping experiences. So skinning birds for the college museum, making study skins, came pretty easily to me.
Wow, very cool. And so that's how you started birding. And then you have birded in all of the counties in New York State.
Yes, all 62.
How
yes.
did that happen?
Oh, it was just a fun thing to do. I decided to, this was many years ago, decades ago. And I was very active in birding, enlisting and that sort of thing. So I just, on weekends, I picked two counties that were adjacent to each other. I'd drive out western part of the state or northern part or someplace else and spend a weekend birding one or two counties on my own and just find a local motel to stay Friday night and Saturday night and then drive home on Sunday and had a good time doing that.
This is pre-eBird app.
Correct.
Time. So how do you get the information of like where to go?
Oh, Susan Grennan published a book, Where to Find Birds in New York State, and I use that as a guide.
Oh.
A book by Susan Grennan was published, I don't know, in the 80s or 90s or something, sometime back there, maybe the 70s.
Mm-hmm. So you just look at this book as a guide?
Yeah. Yep.
And were they successful?
Oh, yeah. I just had a Volkswagen Beetle, and I just drove all over the state and just had a good time.
So you also mentioned that you've already pretty much covered the whole states also, except for the three states.
Correct.
Now.
I've birded most of the United States of America, only three of the 50 states I have left. That's Oregon, Washington, and Nebraska. I plan to go to Nebraska this coming summer with my friend Will Yandick. And my daughter actually lives in Washington, so I need to make a plan to go visit her in Washington and get Oregon at the same time.
And you do the same? Like you looked up where to go? I mean, state is much bigger than counties.
It's easier now with eBird. I can just check that major hotspots on eBird, find out where the good places are.
Right.
I've done that already for Washington and Oregon, so my destinations are already picked out. So make arrangements to go there sometime.
She probably knows that when you visit, you'll bird, right?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be good if, you know, your daughter says, I'd like to come out and see you, but...
Well, we'll have dinner together, things like that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And maybe, so why don't we talk about this book also, since it's here. Adaptations of Desert Organisms, Avian Desert Predators.
That was an interesting phenomenon in my life. I had never intended to write the book, but during my graduate studies, I wrote a paper about feeding relationships between birds and amphibians. I was taking an amphibian course at SUNY Albany with Margaret Stewart. I wrote a paper and a bibliography listing all the references that I could find for feeding relationships between amphibians and birds. Birds that ate amphibians, amphibians eaten by birds. Amphibians that eat birds, and birds eaten by amphibians. I had made four lists. And she said it was such a good job that I should publish it. So I did. It was published. I was a bulletin by the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. And then somebody by the name of John Clousey Thompson, the editor of this series of desert adaptations, that book you're holding is one of the book that I wrote, is one that he, part of this series that he compiled of desert adaptations. John Clousey Thompson, a British scientist, is a desert expert. So he encouraged several authors to contribute to his series, publishing books about adaptations of birds or wildlife things to deserts. That was his specialty. So he asked me to contribute something about predator-prey relationships in deserts. And so I told him I was an ornithologist, so I'd restrict it to the birds. So I wrote that book there titled Adaptations in Desert Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it must include a lot of birds that we're not familiar with in Hudson Valley.
Yes, African species and other desert specialists. Mm. My friend Will Yendick did contribute some of pictures and some drawings, and also a good friend Jim Coe, living in Greene County, did some of the really nice artwork. He's a really good bird artist. He contributed some of the pictures.
Like these illustrations.
Yes,
a
comparison of a lappet-faced vulture and an Egyptian vulture. Extremely nice comparison, showing the different bill sizes, different adaptations for eating different kinds of meat of those two species of vultures. Mm-hmm. You know, the lappet-faced vulture has a huge bill. You can tear open the hide of a hippopotamus or an elephant and get to the inside. But the Egyptian vulture, very diminutive bill, they feed on the scraps and stuff that are left over at the end of the process.
Yeah, this looks quite different. I mean, looking at the heavy beak of a lappet-faced vulture.
Correct.
Very different from the vultures we have tons of them in Hudson.
Yeah, we have two species now here in Hudson. Originally, we only had one, the turkey vulture. Now, the black vulture has extended its range from the south into our area. So the black vulture is a common year-round resident here in Hudson, Columbia County. The turkey vulture is also changing its pattern. The turkey vulture used to migrate out in the winter, totally gone this time of year. But now we can find turkey vultures here pretty much throughout the winter. Not very many, but a few linger around. So we have two species of vultures here flying around Hudson and the Greenport quarries.
Mm-hmm. And this change happened pretty recently. This is our lifetime.
Oh, yes. Within the last 10 or 20 years. When I first started birding back in the 70s, there were one or two reports of black vulture in Columbia County. Very, very rare accidental birds that kind of somehow got lost. But now they're here regularly. They've extended their range into our area and beyond, further north. So, yes, they're extending their range northward, along with many other species of birds as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Bequency on Waveforms, WGXE 90.7 FM. If you're just tuned in, we are listening to my interview with Bill Cook, an ornithologist and curator of the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum, and Chris Franks from Allen DeVoe Bird Club, who is the coordinator of the upcoming open house event at the museum on February 10th.
It seems like this year there are many red-winged blackbirds. And we saw like three yellow-bellied sapsucker the other day, and these things like flagged when we report on eBird
because
they're not common this time of year.
Like, yeah, the blackbirds, that's similar to the vultures. The black vultures, they are migratory, and they used to be pretty much absent in the winter, but now you can find red-winged blackbirds here throughout the winter commonly. The yellow-bellied sapsucker is kind of a different story. They're more of an altitudinal migrant in the summertime. They go up into the Catskills and the Berkshires, and they're hard to find here and down in the valley. But in the wintertime, they kind of drift down in the valley from the Berkshires. It was very interesting to me one time. I did a Christmas count over in Berkshire County with the Hoffman Bird Club, and I was surprised to learn that the yellow-bellied sapsucker is so common there, whereas it's less common down here in the Hudson Valley. But I was also surprised that they had so very few, or practically no, screech owls. Here in the Hudson Valley, we have screech owls here all year round. It's our most common owl. But over up in the hills, up in the mountains of the Berkshires, they were almost unknown. It was surprising. That close, and yet such a major difference in the bird population.
Mm. There must be a lot of change that happened over the course of you observing birds.
Yes, I've been birding since the 70s. There's been a lot of changes, some increases and some decreases. We just talked about some of the increases, like in the black vulture and the blackbirds. But some of the decreases are interesting and unfortunate. That includes ducks, whether waterfowl, and also neotropical migrants like warblers. Both of those categories of birds have been decreasing dramatically. You're talking earlier about ducks on the Hudson River, Chris was talking about the duck count this past weekend, and what you found, maybe four species or five, I mean, mallards, mergansers, you were lucky to find some golden eye and ringneck ducks. Well, 20, 30 years ago, or maybe we'd find maybe 15 species of waterfowl, including perhaps typically a raft of canvasbacks, a thousand. You'd find a group of thousands of canvasbacks. And if you're lucky, look through them real close, you might find a redhead. Golden eyes were like a dime a dozen. All along the river, you'd find big groups of golden eye. Now they're practically a rare bird. And you'd find other things, scaup and scoters and old scaup, which are now called long-tailed ducks. Things like that would be relatively common on the river.
Is there any species that you kind of stopped seeing or you see less now?
Stopped? Well, let's see. Loggerhead shrike is pretty much all gone. There were a few around in the 70s.
Shrikes?
Loggerhead shrike. There's two kinds of shrike. The northern one is called northern shrike, and the southern one is called loggerhead shrike. We still get northern shrike, as Mayuko knows, because she was instrumental in finding a really nice specimen this past month for the Christmas count. But the northern shrikes only come down here in the wintertime. In the summertime, we used to have a species called loggerhead shrike, but they've been gone for decades now. You can still find them commonly in Texas and still in the States, but I think they're pretty much gone from New York State now.
But you used to see it.
They were uncommon when I was beginning birding in the 70s, but they were around.
Mm. I would also like to talk about the ornithological collection of Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum. You're the curator.
That's correct.
And Alan DeVoe Bird Club is going to have an event there. And that's why we have you.
Yes, thanks
Chris
to Chris
Frank,
here.
The organizer of the event. And so do you want to talk about what's happening exactly?
You want to answer that question, Chris?
Well, why don't I, I'll give the logistics first.
Sure.
And then we can talk about kind of what to expect mm-hmm. when they come, because we've done this before. So the event is on February 10th. It's being held at the Columbia Green County Community College. There are going to be two sessions, one at 9 a.m. and one at 11. And because it's interactive, not just an exhibit, so we'll get to that in a moment. So it's interactive participation by the people who come. There's a registration that you need to do. It is free, but you can email the Alan DeVoe Bird Club and say you're interested in coming. Or you can also find us on Facebook under Alan DeVoe Bird Club and send us a message there. And the website also has other information about the location and times and those things, which is Alan DeVoe Bird Club, www.alandevoebirdclub.org. We held this a couple of years ago, and it was very well attended and liked, so we look for something to do field trip-wise in the winter when travel might be difficult. It's 12 degrees out, and Bill has been nice enough to share part of the collection with us and birders. And again, it's open to the public, so I'll let him describe kind of the collection, the size, how it came about, and then some of the exhibits that we put out.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yes, this program will highlight some of the special specimens you have in the collection and also maybe provide some fun opportunities, possibly. Some of the exhibits include, well, we have an egg of passenger pigeon, an extinct species, so there's something that's of interest. We have some specimens in the collection that were collected in New York State, but they are rarities from New York State. For example, wood stork, purple gallinule, and Rufus hummingbird are birds rarely found in New York State, but we have specimens that have been collected in New York. We'll highlight some of the just other oddities, odd plumages, like we have some birds that are white. They're not normally white. This is a phenomenon called leucism. It's quite different. It's a little different than what you would think of as an albino. A white bird that's partially white is called leucism, leuco from the Greek meaning white. Anyway, we have a white red-tailed hawk in the collection, a white blue jay. We have a chickadee with a white tail and things like that. We also have some specimens of cedar waxwings that have red tail tips rather than yellow tail tips. And there's an interesting story about that. It took a while to figure out what that phenomenon was all about. It was thought that at first it might have been a genetic mutation. But it turns out that it's due to their diet. Some birds, when some cedar waxwings, when they're young, they'll eat like honeysuckle berries or something that has a red pigment, and it'll turn their tail band red rather than yellow. Anyway, so we'll highlight some of these interesting specimens from the museum, and then we'll have a couple maybe interesting things for the people. A warbler quiz, a bunch of warblers will be out so they can try to guess what species they are. I'll have feeding adaptations kind of exercise to play if they want to. So that's the idea, is a kind of fun field trip, indoor field trip for the bird club.
Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, helpful, especially for birders or other just in the general public that are interested. What purpose does having collections serve the scientific community and the rest? Because people usually now think about, oh, people in 1900 went out with guns, or 1860s and just shot things and, you know, terrible. But there's a scientific value, and you can see some of those things applied with the specimens and what they have in the collection. And when people and scientists are doing research, they'll go around to different places that have these collections to do measurements to see. Again, Bill kind of just mentioned it, but people were not sure, were these two different species of cedar waxwing? Mm-hmm. And so only by looking at and doing the further work and someone having that. So there's some scientific value, and I think it's good to see how those things are applied.
Yeah.
And of interest.
Yes, our collection has been used for many scientific research projects. One that comes to mind has to do with red crossbills. The species known as red crossbill is an unusual species, has an unusual breeding pattern, and they can breed any time of the year. And the scientists now are believing that these birds represent several different species. And so studies have been done on them. And it turns out, by coincidence, happen to have a very large red crossbill collection, over nearly 50 specimens in our collection, collected by Robert Unick back when there was an eruption of red crossbills in the state. And so we have specimens of so-called different subspecies. And one day, the researchers from New York City, from the American Museum of Natural History, came up. They wrapped up all my crossbills, put them in a box, and took them down to New York City, and they studied them for a couple of years and then sent them back. So that was one way in which the collection has contributed to science. We also have, perhaps our most significant bird in the collection, is a black-throated blue warbler that appears to be half male and half female. One side of the bird, the right side, has male plumage, and then the left side of the bird has female plumage. And so the question is, what in the world causes that? So that bird specimen was sent to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. to do a genetic study. What they found is that both sides of the bird genetically were female. But when I did the dissection, it did have a testis on the right side, and it did have an ovary on the right side. It had both kinds of gonads inside. But genetically, the whole bird was a female. So the reason why it looked different was just basically, apparently, a hormonal variation. The testes produced male hormone for the right side, and the female ovary produced female hormone for the left side. And why both sex organs develop is a question.
If you just tuned in, we are listening to my interview with Bill Cook, an ornithologist and curator of the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum, and Chris Franks from Alan DeVoe Bird Club. This is Frequency on Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM.
And Bill just mentioned something I find very interesting, and he used this phrase, which was, we used to think. So in science, it's not right or wrong. Mm-hmm. It's based on the information and the data available at that time. This is what we, not me, I'm a lay person, just a birder, but Bill and the scientific community, this is what we think. And so then you go into the future and some new discoveries and new things come up of evidence or information and say, we used to think this, we now think that. And having the collections allows you to go back in time and see what the people were looking at and compare those. And then the last one that I'll give to you, because it just kind of ties into this, when people think of evolution, they think of it as being minute changes over long, long periods of time. And one of the pieces is he's talking about this particular black-throated bird, but with Darwin, where the finches, and there were finches whose beaks were varied based off of the crop that and food access that they had, the size of the seeds that were coming. And so they found that evolution was actually could happen much quicker to populations, not just over eons, but just using those. And the way to determine those was actually to capture and measure these same, so to speak, species of finches, but with different attributes about them. So anyway, those are some of the reasons and things that kind of come out of this collecting or research and study.
That was a fascinating study referring to the grants and the work in the Galapagos, you know, showing that evolution is happening all the time. It goes back and forth, and it can be as rapid as one season. The size of the bills of a species of bird can change based on catastrophic events in just one season. The next generation of birds can have larger beaks or smaller beaks based on the size of the seeds that are available based on weather conditions.
That's very interesting. I've heard of like pigments in bird feathers are not necessary. Like, I think it was blue jay. They don't have blue pigments in the feather.
That is an interesting phenomenon, yes. Some colors are due to pigment, like the red in the cardinal is a red pigment. But the red of a ruby-throated hummingbird's throat is not a pigment. And if you turn the feather right, it just looks black. But if you change it, if you reflect the light through it just properly, then you get the feather actually acts like a prism. It sort of breaks apart the light spectrum and shines the red portion of the spectrum back to your eye. So that is an interesting phenomenon. And apparently, and blue jays' feathers are the same way. They're not really blue. They just break up the light and send the blue light back to your eye.
It's kind of mind-blowing. But yeah, that's the kind of thing. You have to look at the bird's skin to really know how that spectrum, light and all that works.
Yeah, so that's another reason why museum specimens are important for scientific study.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I was looking at the website, and they were like search engine website, and it's got, the sex of the bird, skull ossified.
Yeah, skull ossification, that's an indicator of the age of the bird. In the passerines, well, that's the perching birds or songbirds, the young birds, after they hatch, they have only one layer of bone in their skull.
Oh.
But sometime before the second year, a second layer develops, and the two layers are separated by little pillars that can appear as white dots on the surface of the skull. So that's one way to tell the age of a bird, in the sense that you can tell if it's a hatchier bird or after hatchier bird.
Mm. And then there's some other more basic information, like which country, which state, which county, township. And I saw there were a bunch of local Columbia County collected birds.
I collect here mostly in Columbia County, so the Columbia Green Community College does represent Columbia Green counties primarily. So yes, the majority of our collection is local.
Mm-hmm. And there's a collector and donator.
Okay, what's the difference between a collector and donator? Well, in the terms of the bird study skins, the collector is the person who stuffed the bird. The donator is the person who brought the dead bird into the museum, and the collector is the person who takes the bird, skins it, stuffs it, writes up a tag, and in my case, catalogs it in the computer database and that sort of thing. So that's the difference between a donator and a collector.
Uh-huh. And the cause of the death was also kind of interesting. There were a lot of like road kills, cat kill, window kill, and came from many different situations.
Yes. For our collection, I don't have what's called a collector's permit. My friend Jeremy Kirchman at the State Museum has a collector's permit. He can legally go out and shoot birds for his collection. What I have is a salvage permit, which allows me to pick up dead birds. Believe it or not, it's basically illegal for a common everyday pedestrian to pick up a dead bird. Technically, it's illegal.
That was what I was wondering.
Yeah. And the reason for that is, if, say, for example, a person shoots a bald eagle, which is highly illegal, and a police officer sees the person with a bald eagle, and if the person says, "Oh, I didn't shoot it, I just found it," And the police officer says, well, tough luck, buddy. You're still under arrest because it's illegal to have it. So that's the reason for that law.
That's what I was wondering, because I think people can find birds dying from a, I guess, window kill is very common.
Yes, it is. Birds can't see the glass, so they see the trees or something on the other side of the glass. They think they can fly through, and they fly into the window full speed and kill themselves.
And so what's the oldest and newest addition to the collection?
Okay. Well, the oldest one we have is from 1873, I think it is.
Wow.
And that was a solitary sandpiper. But what's interesting, our old specimens, we have several, half a dozen or so, from Eugene Bicknell. We have specimens from 1879 to 1881, stuffed by Eugene Bicknell.
Bicknell, doesn't it in the bird name?
Yeah, he is honored in the name of Bicknell's thrush, which breeds in the, up in the high elevations of the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
He was also somewhat out of a botanist, and so there are like seven plant specimens named for him as well. But he was somewhat local. He was born and lived most of his life in New York. He died in Long Island. I think he was born along in the Hudson Valley somewhere. He did work as a banker in Paris, I know, for a while. But he was interested in natural history and did both ornithological work and botanical work. He wrote some papers about birds of the Catskills in the Hudson River Valley. So yeah, Bicknell is relatively a good, well-known name in the bird world.
Mm.
And we have some of the specimens that he stuffed in our collection. So those are our oldest specimens in the late 1800s. In terms of the newest specimens, still collecting all the time. A week or so ago, it was from my friend Will Yandick. He gave me a Savannah sparrow that he collected in December. So that'd be the newest specimen.
So those are the things that people can expect to see when they come to the event. And there was another thing that Chris also mentioned about certain bird skins that you have in the collection that the Feather Thief prepared for you. So there was a nonfiction book titled The Feather Thief that came out in 2019. And the book is about this 20-year-old American guy who broke into the British Museum of Natural History, which had one of the largest ornithological collections in the world. And he saw a bunch of rare bird skins because he was obsessed with fly tying for fishing thing. And apparently, I didn't know any of this, but it's got many recipes, like esoteric thing, that uses rare bird feathers. And so that became a big story. And speaking of local bird people in the Hudson Valley, I heard that he's local.
And yes, also he is.
He worked.
Can we mention his name or not?
I think it's okay.
Edwin Rist was a student of mine in 2003. He took my bird course. He was an excellent student. I mean, A student, very intelligent, very diligent in his work, very dedicated in whatever he did. And he took my bird course. In the process, we do have a specimen in the collection that he prepared. He prepared a skin of a barred owl, so we have that with his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did at the Tring was so incredibly unfortunate. I mean, he ended up, some of the birds were recovered, but he stole birds of paradise. He stole Cotingas from South America. And some of them were collected by Alfred Russel Wallace. I don't know if you know who he is. He's like Darwin. He came up with the theory of evolution. And he was a colleague of Darwin's and deserves really the same amount of credit that Darwin has for coming up with the theory of evolution by natural selection. Anyway, some of Wallace's birds of paradise from New Guinea, Edwin took, which is really unfortunate. The good thing is that he still grew up to be a fine young man, and he has a good career as a flute player in Germany. And he still is making a contribution to life and science, but he did a bad thing in his life, and everybody's, his family and friends, and everybody's unhappy about it. And it was a tragic event in terms of natural history collections.
Is he also from Claverick?
Yeah, he and his family lived in Claverick. Yep, my hometown.
So that's another thing that people can expect to see.
Happy note.
Sure.
When I first started birding in Columbia County and joined the Allen DeVoe Bird Club, one of our active or participated trips each year, we do one in the spring and one in the fall, is at Olana Historic Site. And Bill traditionally has led that walk. There's one in Labor Day and one in spring. And what was so much fun for all the members of the club was Bill, while he was teaching, would suggest to some of his students that if you would like extra credit, come on the walk. And so one that's funny because it's 7:30 in the morning on a Saturday and getting a college student to get up. Mm-hmm. But I used to say to them that they must really need the extra credit to use on the Saturdays. But they would come and they were interested in asking questions. Oftentimes they were not properly dressed for the weather, which also was kind of, you know, amusing. But it really was a nice interaction between experienced birders that go out all the time and then this young group that is studying birds and then not just in the classroom, but then coming out into the field. And so everyone looked forward to those walks when some of Bill's students were likely to, mm-hmm. you know, to come. So it was always, you know, very enjoyable and fun.
But you didn't have a chance to meet that celebrity of ours.
No.
The local celebrity.
No. But maybe other celebrities of the birding community would show up. And since Bill also mentioned Mr. Guthrie, mm-hmm. One of my first walks with the club was with Bill, and we were doing the Hudson River South. So there's a sister club of ours, the Hudson Mohawk Bird Club, and they would do a walk called the Hudson River North. And so we would, you know, kind of split the Hudson River that way. And so we were, you know, 10 or 12 birders looking through our binoculars, trying to hear in the rest. And then we hear this horned owl call.
What?
Horned owl.
Oh,
great horned owl. And so we were all pretty excited, you know, to hear this. And we were looking through our binoculars. And Bill is not only a great birder through binoculars, but his ears are great, too. And he goes, wait a minute. And it was Rich Guthrie down the road doing the call, knowing that we were on the walk. So I had to take my pencil and erase my listing of a great horned owl that morning. But Bill was able to say, no, that's I've heard that before.
Yeah, I've heard with Rich Guthrie enough to know his imitation of a great horned owl.
That's really funny. Yeah, we did a pretty successful walk that's led by you at Alana. That was this past fall, I guess, a few months ago. That was very productive walk.
I have to thank you for picking out the good birds. As I'm getting older, my eyes aren't quite as sharp as they used to be, so I was depending upon folks like you, Mayuka, to see the birds before and point them out to me so they could identify them. Mm-hmm. So that's what made it so successful. The people on the trip walk were very helpful in terms of finding the birds and pointing them out.
Yeah, I feel like my role in the group is like a dog. Just bark at something and people can tell
that's
me
an important role.
Yeah, so listeners can find the information on those walks organized by Alan DeVore Bird Club. Also on the same website.
Yes.
At www.alandevorebirdclub.org. One word.
Yes.
And so thank you so much for all this wonderful conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure being here.
And thank you, Chris, for the moral support and everything.
So that was the interview. Thanks to Bill and Chris for this conversation. You know, something that left me strong impression from this interview, and also something that we chatted outside the interview, one of the things that Chris Frank said was that it's important to think about not like only about you being an expert of something or you being like very good at something, but also like to look at how much you're helping others to be better at something, you know, what role you are playing for the community. And that's what precisely Bill has been doing for the birding community. And also for to think that Chris making such observation and, you know, have such kind comment just shows how supportive people in the birder community are to each other. And that was really left me in me a strong impression. And so I'm very happy to be now joining it, and I hope you will join us too. It's open to everybody, this birders community here in the Hudson Valley in Columbia County. And the first step you can take to join us is to come to the event of the Columbia Green Community College Natural History Museum that was mentioned in the interview, which is happening on Saturday, February 10th. It's a great chance for the public to get to see its ornithological collection and to learn from it. And like Chris mentioned in the interview, there will be two morning sessions, one at 9 a.m. and the other at 11 a.m. So if you are interested in participating, you can register by contacting Chris at info1, one is the number, info1 at allendevoebirdclub.org, info1 at allendevoebirdclub.org. Allen DeVoe Bird Club is just one word. Or you can contact via Facebook page under Allen DeVoe Bird Club. And more information is available at the club's website, again at www.allendevoebirdclub.org. You're listening to Waveforms WGXC Radio, and this program is Bequency. Now it's time for us to listen to sound made by birds and humans inspired by birds. And I want to play some more tracks from this album, Composition Ornithologique, Ornithological Compositions, which is a 1996 release. It's a music concrete piece by Bernard Fort, a French composer and ornithologist. You know, it's a long time ago when I first listened to this album. And I didn't know anything about birds at the time, nor I wasn't going out to see birds. But at the time I started listening to this album, but I thought it was, you know, what a beautiful and kind of really mysterious sound, and was really fascinated by it. And so this music has been one of my favorites since, for like two decades now. And but now, listening back to this album as someone who's actually interested in birds, and you know, it sounds different, because it makes me happy to think that, oh yes, I know these birds, I have met them in real life. You know, it's really something to be able to appreciate these like little amazing mysteries in real life is a special thing. And so we're gonna hear three tracks. The first one is titled Hermit Thrush. It's something we can see in real life in Hudson Valley. And we're going to hear more of a, I guess more of a music concrete type of piece, but using bird field recordings titled Morning Study and Solitary Study. And here's some words from the composer himself. The hermit thrush is a musical emotion in its purest form. The desolate side, the fragility of the timbre, the melodic contour, the rhythmic flexibility, the structure of the whole, all the parameters of his singing lead to musical listening. I find it hard to believe in the strict functionality of the wonders of nature. So that's what we're going to hear next. Ornithological Compositions by Bernard Fort. Thanks for listening. This is Bequency.
Thank you.
So I have to talk over this beautiful sound, which is Ornithological Compositions, a 1996 release by Bernard Fort. And this is the end of today's show. You're listening to Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM. Coming up here next is The Countdown, produced by Tom Rowe, counting down 10 new sound stories or songs in American Top 40 style. So don't go anywhere. This program has been Bequency, and I have been Mayuko. I'm here every 4th Saturdays of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So I'll be back on February 24th with an interview with Drew Hopkins from New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and Five Rivers Environmental Education Center, which is a living museum comprising over 450 acres of fields, forests, and wetlands in Albany. So I hope you come back and join me again. Happy birding, and I'll see you next time.